afternoon. Today is March 25th, 2020. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And as always, we will start with the call of the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt. Hewitt. Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Ackland.
Present.
Backer. Backer. Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damuth.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grünhagen.
Present.
Kiel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison present.
Munson.
Munson present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam. Quam. Ryer.
Ryer present.
Schultz.
Schultz present.
Wolgamott. Wolgamott. A quorum is present.
Oh, Backer present. Backer present also. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. I got you.
Okay. And I'm sure we'll get Representative Wolgamott and whoever else we missed here as soon as they are able to get on. So thank you, everyone, for joining us on this Friday. We don't usually meet on Fridays, of course, but we are coming up to deadlines. And so we have a lot of bills we need to get heard. And I know we're taking up everyone's Friday afternoon, so we're going to try to be as expeditious as possible. But as always, of course, members have the ability to ask questions we'll have some discussion as well. So the first bill on the agenda then is House File 4398. And this is an agency bill. So I'm just going to let the department present and speak to the bill. And we have an author's amendment. So how can we have an author's amendment? I guess this is for discussion, is the author's amendment. So there is an A1-1 author's amendment. Is that right, Mr. McQuillan?
Yeah, that's right, Madam Chair.
So we're just going to discuss all of that. Okay. All right. So I'm going to, I don't know if the commissioner is here or who do we have from? Okay. Welcome, Ms. Kelly, and please go ahead and introduce yourself and introduce your bill, my bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I want to send the regrets from Commissioner Malcolm. She had hoped to and planned to be here to speak to the revisions to the governor's budget and to this budget bill, but was unable to make it this afternoon. So thank you for the invitation, especially as we head into deadlines and towards the end of the session. We're really appreciative of being back before this committee. And I just want to thank you again, Madam Chair, for the phenomenal support that you've and your committee have provided to our agency over the last 2 years. So we were in front of your committee about a month ago, really excited to talk about the fantastic ways the governor is strengthening public health in Minnesota throughout his budget recommendations. And today I'm going to highlight the revisions to the governor's supplemental budget, some that we're even more excited about because of how they'll transform public health. So we just have a few slides. I understand we will have a future opportunity to speak to the budget in front of this committee, so I'll move quickly. And the governor's revised supplemental budget recommendations add $22 million of general fund resources to our budget in the 22-23 biennium. You see that first line is in red. That's where the change is. $45 million in the 24-25 25 biennium, and we'll talk about those changes in a future slide. This slide here does represent the entirety of the governor's budget recommendations for MMB. The bill before you is about $10 million less in 22-23. It does not include, the bill before you does not include the governor's changes for legalizing adult use marijuana. That proposal does include funding at MDH for some preventive strategies, and that's not in this bill. And if you go to the next slide, just as a reminder, our proposals in the governor's budget this year falls into four buckets. And the first bucket is healthcare access and affordability. And it includes several proposals to address growing healthcare costs that will help us to create a sustainable healthcare system, not just for the state budget, but for employer and family budgets as well. So the proposals you see here on this page are aimed at helping us to get a clearer understanding of what's driving the growth in healthcare costs and what might be some solutions to that, while paying particular attention to our rural care systems. If you go to the next slide. The next bucket includes a variety of public health prevention strategies. And the commissioner may have mentioned this when she was here last, but she's really excited to see these proposals in the budget and grateful for the governor's support in trying to move upstream to address some of the critical issues facing Minnesotans to prevent them from occurring rather than missing that opportunity and having to deal with the consequences and the cost of intervention down the road after something has already happened. So the strategies that you see listed here, like drug overdose and substance use prevention, sentinel event reviews for police-involved deadly encounters, and addressing disability as a health equity issue, these are all tied, tried and true public health practices, but more importantly, are incredibly timely right now to address the needs of our communities across the state. If you move to the next slide. The third bucket is supporting families and children. And these proposals are prevention strategies as well, but are intended to improve the health outcomes of Minnesota families and children, which is one of the governor's key priorities in his budget. And these proposals have leveraged a lot of good interagency work as well. And key among these proposals is the expansion of the family home visiting and the Healthy Beginnings, Healthy Families initiative to reduce disparities in early childhood outcomes. If you move to the next slide, this is the last bucket of proposals, sustaining our public health programs, and it addresses some of the specific work of MDH. And this is where you'll see the revisions to the governor's supplemental budget that are reflected in the bill before you today. The commissioner is really excited about these changes as well. His revised budget released last week includes the public health system transformation and proposal, which replaces the public health workforce proposal that was in his first budget released January or February. And there's also a small update to our medical cannabis program as well. And if you turn to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about both of these. The governor's recommendation for public health system transformation is for an ongoing general fund investment in the state, local, and tribal governmental public health system. And this funding will help the public health system carry out its most basic foundational public health responsibilities. It includes having the skills and resources needed to prevent and control infectious disease, address environmental health threats, improve the health of communities, and improve access to healthcare services at the local level. Over time, eroding funding, emerging health threats, widening health inequities, and the need for new skills and capabilities has really left Minnesota with a public health system that can best be described as a patchwork quilt of programs and activities. And the COVID-19 pandemic has only highlighted the gaps in our public health system. This is really a critical time that we assess where we're at public health to ensure that everyone across the state can get access to the similar services. So health protection shouldn't be based on where you live. And state, local, and tribal public health departments have a unique responsibility in the state here to diagnose, prevent, and respond to public health challenges. and communities rely on public health departments for data, partnerships, and guidance. And this pandemic has really stretched our health departments thin, and they have borne the brunt of much of the work that we have done these past 2 years. So we believe now is the time to make the entire public health system work better for all communities and move from a system driven by a complex mix of inconsistent and inflexible funding to one that every community can expect a basic level of public health protections. So of the total amount recommended each year, $21 million is for grants to community health boards, $1 million for tribal governments, and $1 million for a grant with the Minnesota AmeriCorps organization to strengthen our public health workforce for the future. The next addition to the governor's budget reflected in the bill before you is revisions to the medical cannabis program, a proposal to reduce the fees for all patients enrolled in the state's program to $40, a $40 flat fee. Fees are currently set at either $50 for medical assistance enrollees or $200 for non-medical assistance enrollees. And there's just a small one-time cost to this change, a system cost to this change. And there's also a revenue reduction to the state government special revenue fund. So, Madam Chair, those are the changes to the governor's budget. It's a quick overview of what all is included in this budget bill. I'm happy to answer whatever questions and to go into greater detail if you'd like.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Kelly. And just so members are aware, so the A1-1 is the supplemental budget, so the revised supplemental. So that was sent out to folks, so you all have that. So we have a number of testifiers on this budget, and so as I first call on Commissioner Sheila Cascade, and I just want to note that, so this is Chair's privilege. Often I see the County of Olmsted misspelled, and I'm so glad that on the agenda I have, of course, Mr. McQuillan knows how to spell Olmsted. It does not have an A in it, just for everyone's future reference. Okay, with that, I'm going to call on Commissioner Cascaden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for calling out the proper spelling of Olmsted County. But Madam Chair and members, I am really not representing Olmsted County on this call today. You have in your packet a letter that came from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, and it was from Bill Hutton, the executive director, and myself. And Mr. Hutton and I co-chaired a task force by the put together between the Sheriff's Association and the State Community Health Services Council, and that was about 3 years ago. And we were looking at what's the role of counties in meeting the needs of children of incarcerated parents. And that's that work that we did. We're continuing to work together now through JJAC, but we were really very pleased to see that some of the supplementary budget proposal you have before you has a number of policy and budget proposals that are really directed at increasing the capacity of children of incarcerated parents to improve their resiliency, to keep the relationship with their parents. And we know that we commissioned a study that Rebecca Schaffler of the University of Minnesota did of all of our jails three, 4 years ago. And we had really good participation of county jails. And we found that 67% of all those who were detained in our jails, whether male or female, had children under 18. And we know from the adverse childhood experiences of work that having an incarcerated parent is one of those really significant adverse childhood experiences and is often accompanied by other things like substance abuse or domestic violence. And yet this is a population of kids that our systems haven't paid attention to. And yet there is evidence, also very strong evidence, that intervention with those children and their caregivers and their incarcerated parents can have a huge preventative impact in preventing juvenile delinquency, improving school performance. It's a really smart way to deal with prevention of juvenile delinquency, for one thing, but also improves outcomes for the incarcerated parents, reduces recidivism, Having contact with your family is one of the greatest predictors of you being able to reenter and be law-abiding and stay out of our court systems in the future. So we were extremely pleased to see that you have some proposals in the governor's budget for the Department of Corrections to create a family support unit and to invest in connecting families who have an incarcerated parent. And we also were extremely pleased to see the home visiting components of the Department of Health's budget, the home visiting expansion, the healthy beginnings pieces. There are programs in other states which we hope Minnesota can look at that use intensive home services as an alternative to incarceration, particularly for women with young children. And so we just wanted to take a moment, and I know we've got a very full agenda, to say that the Sheriff's Association and the State Community Health Advisory Council, we really support these provisions in the governor's budget, and we hope that they will be fully funded at the end of this session. And then wearing my hat as the State Community Health Advisory Council board chair this year, we really are excited about the work that we're doing at your direction to transform public health, to look to what we need for public health of the future, to have a strong a state-local partnership, a strong infrastructure for public health long into our future. And we're very excited to see the proposals in the budget that you gave last year that we're working on currently around some of those innovation grants and things, and into the future for the kind of investment we need. I've been attending a lot of national webinars, and underinvestment in public health is a national issue. And COVID, if nothing else, showed us that it's time to make those investments. It not only helps us with disease response and prevention, but it really helps us with those deep, deep health inequities that we have in our state. So I encourage you on both fronts that the proposal and the supplemental budget should deserve your support. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Appreciate your testimony today. Next on the list, I have Art Rolnick. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Art Rolnick. I'm an associate economist at the University of Minnesota, formerly director of research at the Federal Reserve Bank of the Office. I'm here today to speak on behalf of HF 4398, which includes funding for family home visits, especially for our priority populations, including incarcerated families, and funding to sustain and expand grants for model jail practices for incarcerated parents. My testimony today will be about an incarcerated parents program developed by scholars at Yale University of Medicine. It's titled Mentoring Incarcerated Fathers Investing in Early Childhood Education, probably one of the best public investments we can make. The initial pilot employed peer mentors, let me stress that, working with 56 incarcerated fathers. There was a control group, and so it was a randomized control group, so the methodology was really strong. And they were mentored far before they were released. And the initial findings were very promising, a significant reduction in recidivism. I am now working with the Yale scholars on a second phase of the study, where we hope to engage a much larger number of fathers and continue peer mentoring well after they are released. Think of that as home visiting. In addition, we will assess the impact of the program not only on the fathers, but also on the children, especially the infants and toddlers. As you know, the very earliest years of a child's development are critical for brain development, and we will ultimately have a significant impact on a child's success with these kind of interventions. And their parents' involvement, as you all know, is critical to that development. So in phase two of the pilot, we believe we will show significant benefits, not only in terms of a reduction in recidivism, but on tangible measures of a child's health, cognitive, and emotional progress. This is why I think HF 4398 is such a wise investment for the state of Minnesota. This is a future workforce. We can't afford for these kids not to succeed in school and in life. This is a very high public return. Again, thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to make the case for these fathers and for these children and for these families.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Rolnick. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I have Mia Debbins. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mia Debbins. I'm a senior community health worker in the Hennepin Health Access Clinic. I'll refer to it as HHA, at Hennepin Healthcare. And I've been a CHW for 8 years and worked with Hennepin Healthcare for 32 years. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Community Health Worker Alliance in support of the community health worker provisions in the proposal before you today. The HHA clinic I work in provides support for patients who have significant barriers to primary care. The patients we see are frequently utilizing the emergency services for their care and experience psychosocial challenges, including chemical dependency, homelessness, and or unsupported mental illness. I'll share a couple examples of the importance of community health workers. Recently, a patient was struggling with his DRH housing situation, and he had multiple roommates and had switched group homes multiple times because his mental health was declining and his anxiety was increasing, having to live with multiple people in the home. So I was able to use my relationship as a trusted member in the community with a landlord to reduce some of the usual barriers for the patients, like background checks, credit checks, income requirement of 3 times the income for rent. And right now, our patient is in an apartment. He's working full time. He's been stably housed for about 6 months in a market rate unit, and his mental health has in fact improved. This patient would likely have continued to use DRH. He's in other public programs without my support as a community health worker. I work with a multidisciplinary team of doctors, nurses, social workers, community paramedics, alcohol and drug counselors, and other health professionals to address social determinants of health, increase engagement in healthcare, and improve health and well-being, such as different things that we would do in the clinic. I manage a clothing closet near our clinic to easily secure clothing and basic needs for our patients who are predominantly homeless, and they're often out in the weather in inappropriate attire. So this is a good way for us to avoid patients getting heat stroke or hypothermia or frostbite. And of course, we know clean and warm clothing, is especially good socks, are always a way to improve dignity and respect. I connect patients to medical appointments, transportation, and reduce ED utilization by working to reengage our patients in primary care. Two patients and I recently studied for weeks for the 100 American citizenship questions, and then both of the patients passed. And I've assisted patients in navigating job searches. We kind of buff and shine up their resumes. We've studied for forklift exams and driver license exams, and I helped a patient even get workbooks to get into a job in construction that he was longing to do. The list goes on and on. So in closing, community health workers are an investment in racially and ethnically marginalized and rural communities because we come from the communities that we serve. We improve the quality and cultural appropriateness and equity of healthcare and related services. We address the social drivers of health, which determine the success or failure of healthcare beyond the clinic walls. And we're also trusted liaisons between healthcare, social services, and the community. Thank you to the governor and the MDH for this proposal, to Representative Liebling for carrying this bill, and to the committee for allowing me the opportunity to testify today.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Debbins. And I know there were a number of other people who wanted to come and give us, you know, support this as well. And we appreciate you standing in for lots of other people on this topic. So very, very good. Thank you. Okay, Matt Toburin, welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Matt Toburin, he, him, Executive Director of the Aliveness Project, a community center serving people living with and at high risk for HIV/AIDS. I come to you today because Minnesota is in a crisis. We are currently experiencing a public health infectious disease outbreak, and it's not COVID. For the first time in the history of the AIDS epidemic, the Minnesota Department of Health has officially declared an HIV outbreak. If we weren't living through another global pandemic, This would and should be front page news. 114 new cases of HIV as a result of this current outbreak. There are 94 new cases in the Twin Cities and 20 new cases in the Duluth area. The outbreak is connected to homelessness, homeless encampments, and intravenous drug use. Just this morning, our street outreach team tested and newly diagnosed a woman with HIV in South Minneapolis. This is heartbreaking, but not surprising. This is the predictable pattern of the opioid epidemic. When the use of opioids spikes, rising HIV rates follow. But there is good news. We know how to stop this outbreak. In the state of Indiana, at the height of their similar opioid-driven HIV outbreak, then-Governor Mike Pence instituted harm reduction and syringe exchange services. And it worked. Cost-effective, evidence-based public health interventions can and do effectively prevent and stop disease transmission. Not only will this proposal have a massive public health impact, but it will also create financial savings to the state. The cost of medical care, medications, and services cost state public health care programs millions of dollars in the lifetime care and treatment for each new infection. We can invest a small amount of money right now to stop this outbreak, or we can spend many times more for decades to come. This legislation is the most effective tool in our toolbox to stop this current outbreak. We cannot afford inaction. The proposed funding will save lives and protect the health of Minnesotans by preventing and reducing the transmission of HIV, hepatitis C, and preventing overdose deaths. We all share the same goal. We all want fewer Minnesotans living with HIV. Thank you, Governor Walz, for taking the lead on combating this public health crisis. And we thank the Minnesota House of Representatives for answering that call. We cannot afford to wait. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Toburin. And to that, I have to add, thank the Minnesota Department of Health. Yeah, yes, absolutely. Okay, next I have Christina Moorhead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Christina Moorhead. I'm a Deputy Vice President of State Policy for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. We represent the country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical research companies. We are here today because we respectfully oppose Article 1, Sections 5 through 12 of House Files 4398, which amends the 2020 Drug Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act to include up to 500 prescription drugs of substantial public interest in drug product families, and also does not amend the confidentiality and trade secret protections that were included in that act to include those new reporting requirements. So in 2020, the Minnesota legislature passed the Prescription Drug Price Transparency Act, which requires drug manufacturers to report certain information when the price of a medicine increases by a certain percentage over a period of time. And PhRMA has worked in good faith with the Minnesota Department of Health over the past year to implement this act. The final user guide became available, and the portal to report information went live 1 month ago, and initial drug manufacturer reports should be due this month. And it's expected that the initial information from these reports will be available later this year. However, House File 4398 substantially increases the number of prescription medicines reporting information to the state before current reporting requirements have been evaluated and assessed. So we would urge you to pause any additional reporting mandates on drug manufacturers until the current reports have been fully implemented and assessed to understand if those are meaningful. We also have concerns with the inclusion of drug product families, which would capture drug manufacturers not identified as a prescription drug of substantial public interest and could dramatically increase the scope far beyond 500 prescription medicines. While House File 4398 would require the Department of Health to consider certain criteria in selecting prescription drugs for reporting, the Department of Health may also rely on any information the department deems relevant and then apply reporting requirements to entire drug product families. So we believe this provision unfairly burdens manufacturers with expanded reporting requirements based on another manufacturer's pricing decisions or on the broad authority given to the Department of Health. And so this creates a disconnect between pricing actions and the reasons for filing a report. And we believe that this is unfair given the significant reporting and penalties associated with these requirements. And finally, we have concerns that the existing Prescription Drug Transparency Act confidentiality and trade secret protections for manufacturers were not expanded in this revision to cover additional reporting requirements that are included in this bill. So the proposed language introduces the new term reporting entity, which includes drug manufacturers and others to report information to the Department of Health. However, the confidentiality and trade secret protection language was not amended to include reporting entities, and the process to request the commissioner withhold not public or trade secret information. So we believe that manufacturers should be changed to reporting entity, or all the reporting entities should be listed in order to so that they are able to use this process to request withholding of information under the existing confidentiality and trade secret protections. So in summary, while well-intended, we think House File 4398 is premature in adding additional transparency reporting requirements, and we also have concerns that the existing trade secret and confidentiality protections are not covering the new reporting requirements. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Moorhead. Next, I have Deb Ditburner. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Dr. Deb Ditburner. I'm a chief medical officer at Alamere Health in Alexandria, Minnesota, and a practicing rural family physician. I'm also current president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. My academy supports many of the provisions in this bill, but today I want to focus on those addressing our healthcare workforce needs and the increased funding for programs to increase training for primary care practitioners to serve our rural and underserved regions. We have seen a growing rural physician shortage coming for years. According to the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, only 1 in 5 providers practice anywhere outside the urban areas of the Twin Cities, Rochester, Duluth, St. Cloud, or Moorhead. In addition, rural physicians tend to be older than those practicing in urban settings. We have a potential crisis brewing. According to the Association of American Medical Colleges, an additional 14,100 to 17,600 physicians are needed across the country to address the shortages in rural areas. One of the challenges is our current healthcare education systems tend to be urban-centric. Physicians trained in urban areas may not be prepared for the challenges of working in rural communities. In addition, the urban-based training frequently draws potential healthcare professionals away from rural areas. Students from rural communities must travel or relocate to an urban area for their coursework and may not return. My academy also strongly supports the funding for new primary care residency training grants included in this bill. These new funds in Section 28 provide grants to establish rural physician residency programs to train future physicians in rural Minnesota. Additionally, unanimous support is given to Section 29, which also will provide training grants to clinical education for medical students, pharmacists, dentists, advanced practice nurses, and more. The focus of these grants is to train healthcare workers to practice in high-need and professional shortage areas. I am an example of success at this type of grant. I grew up on the east side of St. Paul, but because of Rural Physicians Associate Program, or RPAP, that I participated in during medical school at the U of M, I returned to Alexandria, Minnesota to practice, and I have been here for 25 years. And finally, the MAFP supports Section 46 that establishes community-based grants to expand and strengthen the community health workers' workforce. These workers are critical members of primary care teams as they work on the social determinants of health and increase access to health care and wellness for those in need. Expanding our primary care physician workforce is about more than just increasing the supply. It is about reinvigorating the practice of team-based primary care to keep the number of physicians we have and to make the profession more attractive to younger physicians, especially in rural Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I encourage you to support these needed programs to ensure we have a strong healthcare workforce throughout our great state.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Ditburner. Appreciate your testimony. So we have two more testifiers on this bill. I do want to note for members that we will be returning to this bill on Monday, and we can take more testimony. We can also have discussion on Monday. But of course, the testifiers who are here today are the ones, if you have a specific question, we'll take your question after we get through the testifiers. So next we have Trevor Turner. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability. There's quite a few provisions in this bill that Minnesota Council on Disability supports, but I wanted to highlight two that are especially salient. The Minnesota Council on Disability would like to express our support for Section 34 of House File 4398 regarding long COVID, supporting survivors and monitoring impact, and Section 47 regarding reducing health disparities for among people with disabilities. The COVID-19 pandemic has been a mass disabling event with a lifelong health and disability consequences. Minnesota must support its residents who are dealing with long COVID issues and monitor the lasting impact this pandemic has had on our state. Section 34 establishes a program to conduct community needs assessments, epidemiological studies, and establishes a population-based surveillance system to address long COVID. The program will award contracts and competitive grants to organizations that serve communities disproportionately impacted by COVID-19, like Minnesotans with disabilities. Understanding the long-term impact of COVID-19 on Minnesotans will ensure that the policies around long COVID are data-informed and improve the lives of Minnesotans with disabilities due to COVID-19. And then many Minnesotans with disabilities have complex healthcare needs. Still, they often face barriers to receiving adequate healthcare due to healthcare costs, lack of coverage, discrimination, and more. Addressing these issues through data collection and tracking will help close the disparity gap in health for those people with disabilities. Section 47 does this by providing community grants and expanding the disability hub will increase access to and promote inclusive evidence-based chronic disease prevention and management services. Connecting people with disabilities to person-centered care and evidence-based healthcare interventions can help prevent health complications and improve the quality of life. About 20% of Minnesotans have a disability, and national data suggests that Black, Indigenous, and people of color are disproportionately affected by disability and experience compounding disparities like higher healthcare costs, poorer health outcomes, and barriers to care. This work will create a space and build trust, integrating lived experiences and community needs with public health approach for improving the lives of people with disabilities across the lifespan. So Minnesota Council on Disability urges the community to support these provisions and support Minnesotans with disabilities. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for members of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Turner. And then we have Sue Abderholden. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. There is a lot to like in this bill, the community health workers, the deadly force encounter, helping children of incarcerated parents, and the mental health cultural workforce piece. But today I really want to focus on suicide prevention. I think, as you know, Minnesota has mobile mental health crisis teams covering all 87 counties, and there are over 40 phone numbers to contact them. There is also a national suicide lifeline and text line, but again, there are a lot of numbers to remember. And it's always harder to remember these numbers in a crisis. While Travis's law passed by the legislature makes it clear that if you call 911 with a mental health crisis, they can send out a mobile crisis team if appropriate, there are still gaps in responses, and not everyone who is suicidal is going to call 911. They may just need to talk to someone. In October of 2020, Congress passed the National Suicide Hotline Designation Act, which represents 2 years of work to create a three-digit number for people across the country to call when they are suicidal or having a mental health crisis. The number that we can all call in July of this year is 988, a simple number to remember. In order for 988 to be implemented, each state must establish call centers to answer the calls and texts coming from their state and work to ensure that those call centers are knowledgeable about community resources and that the state works towards establishing a comprehensive mental health crisis system. We are a little bit ahead of other states in terms of a system because we have mobile crisis teams, psychiatric emergency rooms, and crisis homes. There's been a large working group in Minnesota to move forward on this issue. Like many states, Minnesota is recommending that we develop a dedicated account to implement 988 and fund it by implementing a telecommunications surcharge along with appropriations and grants. That surcharge would not be more than 12 cents a month. Four states have already passed bills with a fee, and three have a bill pending, and many like us are working on it this session. It's extremely important that we put more money into being able to answer these calls. Right now, we are not answering 100% of the calls to the Lifeline from Minnesota, and we are not answering the texts at all. We must increase our capacity to respond to these calls and texts. On behalf of NAMI Minnesota, Mental Health Minnesota, and the Mental Health Legislative Network, we urge your support for this section of the bill. Answering this one call can save a life. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. So I thought I saw Representative Quam's hand up before. Representative Quam, did you want to go first?
Madam Chair, I was the specific testifier. I was just trying to understand why Duluth and why the cities and the counties weren't directly addressing this spike and outbreak of HIV. And they have quite a bit of resources to try and address that, because if it's a health emergency in addressing it, waiting for us to listen to a proposal, work through a bill, put it in the next year's budget, et cetera, it grows. So that was my concern, is I would hope that the local county and city would be working directly to do what they can now instead of, waiting for this process. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Quam. I don't know if Mr. Toburin wants to respond to that. Mr. Toburin, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I can't speak to all the efforts of the counties, but what I can say is that there is a lot of work. There's a significant amount of work, a significant amount of effort, and thanks to the Minnesota Department of Health, a lot of collaboration of bringing a lot of the state and local and county public health and hospital and providers together to address this crisis and this issue. And so there is a lot of good work being done. It's just it's a steep hill to climb.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Toburin. Appreciate that. Okay, Representative Backer.
Thank you. Had to unmute here. I'm MDH. If MDH is still on, probably would be the best one. How many FTEs does MDH currently have? Because this bill, from what I can tell, is looking to add 200 more. So that's my question there, Madam. My first question, Madam Chair.
All right, Deputy Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Becker. We currently have, I believe we're between 1,500 and 1,600 FTEs, although that number probably fluctuates week to week with our pandemic response as we bring on staff and let staff go based on what the needs for the response are. I don't recall the exact number in our base budget, but we can get that for you. But that's where we're at.
All right. And Ms. Kelly, I always get mixed up on what's your title? Are you Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner? I
want to call you that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Right, Deputy Commissioner.
Deputy. All right. Thank you very much. Representative Backer?
Yeah, thank you. This question is probably more for the author. How do you see this transforming our public health? I mean, what will $200 million a year allow us to change?
So, Representative Backer, this is the department's, this is the governor's budget in the health, for the health department that's being presented today, because I'm the committee chair, I'm the author of the bill, but obviously I'm not the author in the sense that people think of that. I didn't write the bill. This isn't coming from me, it's coming from the department. So I really can't answer that directly. We always hear the governor's budget, and then we consider the proposals the governor is making as we put together our budget bill for the committee. So, you know, if you have, I think that would be a question much more appropriately directed to Deputy Kelly than to me.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if Deputy Kelly could
okay.
Share that, that's fine. I really didn't know how much you were involved there, Chair, and I appreciate you sharing. So, I mean, what is the governor, Deputy Kelly, looking to do with this? I mean, $20 million is a pretty good chunk of change. And what's the ultimate goal of changing the public health? And why is the governor asking for this type of investment? What's the specific outcome that the governor and his staff is looking to achieve with this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Becker. I think that this is an incredible opportunity to make a significant investment in our public health strategies across the state, both at the state level and at the local level and with our tribal health partners. There's a couple of things in here that I believe are transformative in how we address reach out and improve the health of Minnesotans. And I think you, from some of the testifiers you heard today, they have touched on that. A big piece of this $200 million investment is in the home visiting initiative, which is trying to take a tried and true evidence-based strategy that improves the health of our youngest Minnesotans for their long-term potential. By doing small interventions and providing a public health nurse to meet with families, parents, individuals at their earliest stages of development. Well, that's a significant portion of the $200 million investment. But as you also heard with some of the public health prevention strategies around opioid abuse and prevention, suicide prevention, dealing with the HIV epidemic. These are all opportunities we have to change the course of people's lives. And by doing the upstream work, preventing these things from occurring in the first place so that we don't have to invest enormous resources on the back end in the Department of Human Services Medicaid budget. I'm happy to talk more in depth on Monday when we come back, but those are just some of the simple things. And looking too at the investments in addressing some of our healthcare cost issues and how can we get ahead of those as well so that we can make our healthcare budget at the state level more sustainable looking forward as well. So there's a lot of opportunity in this budget to make significant improvement in people's lives to avoid issues in the future.
Thank you, Deputy Kelly. And let me just add to that kind of from the high level is that, so we know that public health, when public health is really working well, nobody knows it's there. It's hard to, you know, when we're talking about preventing things, people don't know that something's been prevented. But yet public health for relatively little money is the thing that's really given Americans much longer life expectancies over time. And we've often seen the commissioner's presentation, usually at the beginning of a session, she'll present it talking about how much of that is medical care, how much of it is, you know, conditions of life, how much of it is public health. And we did make a significant investment in the last budget last year in local public health to try to build up our resources in this way. And we were partnered with Senator Benson and others in the Senate to do that. So good bipartisan investment there. But the pandemic really has shone a light on the weakness in our system. It was plugging along okay, sort of, until we had a big need to ramp up our systems very, very quickly. And I know we'd all like to think that we're done, but I'm pretty sure we're not. And if it isn't COVID, it's going to be something else. So that's just even in that one area, we really see the foundational, critical importance of public health in our state. And we've been, I think we think of ourselves as leaders. It's our Minnesota exceptionalism. And this is one area where I personally would really like us to be and remain exceptional, is in our public health capabilities. And so I think that that's part of what we're doing. Anything else, Representative Backer?
No, and so I agree 100%. In my volunteer time, I see what happens when we don't get ahead of the issue. I do believe our public health works well, better than other states, because it's a county-based program. Those are the people closest to the ground. No disrespect with Assistant Commissioner Kelly. You're not on the front line, okay? You have a different, but when we can empower the people on the front line, and I just, one of the things is, and some of this is trial and error, but we do know that in some programs, they're not as efficient as others. And I think if we give the tools and the flexibility to the county folks, because what works in Traverse County is not going to work in Blue Earth County necessarily. There's going to be some crossover. So I do appreciate that. I'll save more comments on Monday. But at the end of the day, you know, adding 200 additional people and staff, that's an increase in resources that are going to be more central focused in St. Paul, potentially, than out in the county. And that's where I would like to see our investment is, because those are the people that walk in the home and see a diabetic that just had fried food, should not be having fried food. And then they go into have to call 911 and ask me how I know. I've been on several of those runs. So I like to see more investments into the county level. So thank you, Madam Chair and Deputy Kelly.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer.
Madam Chair, if Kelly, I could, yeah. We're happy to come back on Monday to break down specifically how much of the investment is within the state health department and how much is being pushed out to community-based organizations and to local public health. But I totally agree with you, Representative Backer, the value of our county health departments and how they are on the front line and they are delivering the services. And that's why the governor's revision with the public health transformation is so important, that the investment made at the county level varies county to county, from anywhere from a small per capita investment of $8 to $153 at the local level. And what this is trying to do is make sure that every county has similar resources. But I'm happy to provide more information on that on Monday in terms of how the dollars are being spent.
Yes, great. To be continued. Thank you very much, Deputy Kelly. There's a lot to discuss here, a lot of things that are very important to all of us and to all of Minnesota. So with that, so we don't have a bill before us. I don't have one to lay over, so we're just going to move on then. Thank you very much, testifiers, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So now we will take up House File 3862, and there is a division report on House File 3862. So, Representative Freiberg, did you care to move the division report?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the division report.
All right, so Representative Freiberg is moving adoption of the division report on House File 3862. All in favor of adoption of the division report, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the division report is adopted. And with that, we're going to, Representative Bolden, it's her bill, is going to move that House File 3862 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Bolden, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am grateful to be before you today to present this bill. This is a bill aimed at protecting Minnesotans, keeping them healthy, and being proactive. After 2 years of a global pandemic, Minnesotans have been through a lot. As of yesterday, we have had more than 1.4 million cases of COVID-19 in our state, and 12,369 Minnesotans have lost their lives because of it. We know more about COVID-19 now than we ever have. We know that close-fitting, high-quality masks help to slow the spread and keep people safe. We know that easy-to-use, accurate, rapid antigen home tests give people information that helps them to make decisions about how to keep people safe. We know that vaccines are safe and effective. Thankfully, 66% of Minnesotans are now fully vaccinated. We know the pandemic has not impacted everyone equally and that communities of color continue to be disproportionately affected. While we don't know the full impact, we do know that COVID-19 can have ongoing effects for many, sometimes called long COVID, and we've heard about this phenomenon in our committee here before, and there's still much to be learned about that. Overall, we are in a much better place today in terms of case numbers and hospitalizations. For that, we can all be grateful, but we don't know what the future holds. Worldwide, less than 59% of the population is fully vaccinated, and this leaves the door open for new variants and future waves. Additionally, there are still folks who remain at increased risk. For example, those who are immunocompromised and kids under five who still cannot be vaccinated. For all these reasons, this bill is aimed at being proactive and using our power and roles as legislators to ensure that we have strategies in place to keep Minnesotans safe as we move forward. So this bill would create a program to allow the Minnesota Department of Health to distribute KN95 masks and rapid antigen tests directly to Minnesotans at no cost to them.
And Representative Bolden, I'm so sorry, but we forgot that we have to adopt your amendment, because I think you are going to speak. You are speaking to the amended version.
Correct. Right? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's my fault. So Representative Bolden is moving the DE4 amendment, which puts the bill in the order in which she is currently discussing it. So if we could just adopt that, members, we'll continue from there. So all in favor of the DE4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The DE4 is adopted. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said, this bill would ask the Minnesota Department of Health to distribute high-quality, close-fitting masks and rapid antigen tests directly to Minnesotans at no cost to them. Providing these tools to those who want them will allow Minnesotans to take the actions we know keep each other safe. So I do have one testifier, Madam Chair, to speak to the value of this. So with your permission, I will turn it over to him, and we'll be happy to stand for questions. I believe MDH is also on the call to answer questions if needed. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Representative Bolden. And Caleb Schultz, Dr. Schultz, welcome. Good to see you. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Caleb Schultz, and I am testifying in support of House File 3862 on behalf of the Twin Cities Medical Society, a physician-led organization focused on advocacy for better health, where I serve on the Board of Trustees. I'm also testifying as a member of the Minnesota Public Health Association, where I serve on the Policy and Advocacy Committee. As physicians and public health advocates, my colleagues and I know all too well the threat that COVID still poses to Minnesotans of all ages. During the pandemic, we have learned constantly and quickly adapted to face the challenge. We expect the same from our elected officials. While vaccines are important, yet tragically underutilized tool in preventing and lessening the harmful impacts of COVID, other mitigation measures are necessary. HF 3862 establishes a program to distribute antigen COVID tests and KN95 respirators, which will help eliminate barriers, real or perceived, to combating our common invisible enemy. And while we all hope we are done battling with COVID-19, hope is not a strategy. We must remain vigilant, and our state must be prepared for future surges. Today, I'm not only speaking as a physician and a public health advocate, but also as a father of young children, the youngest of whom is not eligible even for vaccination. And personally, as a patient at high risk of poor COVID-19 outcomes. This legislation helps ensure people at the highest risk, like me, can have easy access to high-quality respirators and rapid testing kits. The bill is a straightforward proposal that will help Minnesotans. I hope you will support physicians, public health professionals, and your high-risk neighbors, and vote yes. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Schultz. Okay, so with that, are there any questions or discussion from members? All right, not seeing any. Final word, Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Schultz, for testifying. Ask for member support. This is a way for us to be proactive and to take steps now to protect Minnesotans now and into the future. So thank you.
All right, thank you very much. So House Bill 3862, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. The next bill on the agenda is House File 633. This is Representative Bierman's bill. And members, we have discussed this in the past. And so we shouldn't probably need to do a complete rehearing of the bill. But so Representative Bierman is moving that House File 633, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the General Register. And he does have an author's amendment, I believe. Right, Representative Bierman?
Yes, Madam Chair, I do have the A2, which is an amendment that has some minor cleanup and clarifies payment terms for health plans and PBMs to pharmacies. So I'd like to move that amendment, please.
All right. So Representative Bierman is moving the A2 amendment. And let's adopt the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion to the A2? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails and the A2 is adopted. So, Representative Bierman, if you would like to remind us of what 633 does, and especially with the amendment that we just adopted, and then we will be voting on it so that we can move it to the floor.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I do appreciate the opportunity to just speak again a little bit about House File 633. This bill, as Madam Chair mentioned, was endorsed last year as part of our Health and Human Services package. 633 would provide relief to people in the individual and small group markets who face costly monthly prescriptions. The bill would require plans to offer these markets these copay pre-deductible prescription drug benefits with the highest copays that are capped at 1/12 of the annual maximum out-of-pocket. And these copays are pre-deductible, so the plan member doesn't have to write a check several thousand dollars before coverage begins. Benefit offering is a lot like your local utility offering you a budget plan for paying your natural gas expenses over the course of a full year, but in this case, helping patients avoid the heavy burden thousands of dollars in upfront deductible and coinsurance costs in January and February. Last year, the health plans asked for an actuarial review of House File 633 to evaluate its impact on the health insurance market, and the Department of Commerce completed that review in January with input from the plans and consumer advocates, and the department reported that this bill would improve public health and reduce consumer financial barriers to healthcare, with most insurers noting no significant impact on premiums. The department can also confirm the copay-only benefit model is currently viable at the gold, silver, and bronze medal tiers. So members, 11 states have adopted some form of this drug benefit restructuring to make drug costs more manageable for patients. Illinois was the last one, very similar to House File 633 last year, and Colorado is in its fourth year of copay-only reform. Their state insurance department wrote a letter that is in your packet today outlining the success of the model. And additionally, members, the federal government is taking steps to adopt a copay-only standard benefit alternative starting in 2023 for states on the federal exchange. This means that in a year's time, Minnesota will likely be one of fewer than 10 states without a copay reform model in place for its individual and small group markets. Finally, it's essential to note, members, that this bill is not a mandate for a benefit that people must purchase. It has no fiscal cost, and its impact on insurers is minimal. But it will make a big difference for thousands of Minnesotans and has the support of more than 20 state and national patient advocacy, medical, pharmacy, and public health groups. So, Madam Chair, I do have a testifier available, and I was hoping we could hear from Monica Teese to share her story of how House File 633 would help her as a metastatic breast cancer survivor working for a small
Absolutely.
Employer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bierman. Monica Teese, welcome to the committee.
Hi there, Madam Chair, Liebling, and members of the committee. My name is Monica Teese, and I'm a paralegal and single mom of two college students. I live in Robbinsdale. And this June, I will be a 30-year cancer survivor. I am also a volunteer at the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about my story, just for, I guess, real-life relation to this bill, and explain my support for House File 633. In the summer of 1992, I was diagnosed with stage 3 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in 2004, I was diagnosed with stage 1 breast cancer, 2011, stage 3 breast cancer, and in 2015, stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, which is currently not curable. As we all hear, prescription drugs can be extremely expensive. And my deductible for my current plan is $4,300 a year, and spread out over 12 months, that's fairly doable. But with cancer, you don't get the full year. A lot of times we have prescriptions that meet our deductible within, well, this year I think I made it to the 7th of the of January 7th, where I had to come up with my full deductible. But it's usually within the first few weeks or the first month of the year, every year. And in order to get my medication filled, some drugs are through what's called a specialty pharmacy. And in order to get your medication filled through the specialty pharmacy, you need to pay upfront for your medication. And I had a drug that was $12,000 for a 21-day supply. So come January 1st, I need to refill my prescription, and I need to pay for the full deductible upfront to get my medication. And so what do? I empty out all my accounts. I put the balance on a credit card and get my prescription. I can't wait for it. It's not like it's ibuprofen. It's keeping me alive. It's prescription medication for cancer. And I also am fortunate that I have an employer that consults with me every year about what my health needs, insurance needs are, and includes me on the decision on helping to choose our insurance for the year. My employer gives us all a set amount of money every year that we can either go to the out into the network, or we can go with our group plan through work. And if I decided to switch over to the individual market, this bill would mean that there would be plans available to me to better manage my prescription drug costs. What I appreciate most about House File 633 is that if people like me need options, cancer isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. And we need options available to us for our care. And if you don't want this type of prescription drug coverage, you don't need to sign up for it. But if you're someone like me living with cancer or another chronic illness, this is an option for more affordable drug coverage for us. And it's an option for us. Cancer's really, really hard. And the financial toxicity of it makes it even harder. And this bill would help alleviate some of the burden that patients have to feel on a regular basis to cover their expenses. And it would allow us to just focus on our treatment and getting better. So I would ask that everyone vote yes for House File 633. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Tice. Appreciate your testimony here today. Question from Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. This one is a question for the author. My question is, how does a plan with no deductible and a mandate flat copay have the same premiums as a plan with costs spread across those cost sharing options? That would be my question to Representative Bierman. Thank you.
Representative Bierman?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Backer. So the cost that is spread across is the drug benefit. So there is still a deductible that is required, but in order to access the drug benefit, the consumer does not need to pay the deductible first. So that's what it is. You still would pay a deductible, and that would depend on who you are and where you get your plan and your age and all of those other things that factor into your cost of your deductible. But you would be able to access your out-of-pocket expenses for the drugs that you need over a 12-month period, and that's what's divided up. Does that answer your question?
Representative Backer?
Yeah, I just, because from when I read it, I read the bill as that there's no deduction. What you're saying is there will be you're saying that there's no deduction for drug benefits. Am I understanding how you answer that, or it's not connected 100%?
Representative Backer, this is about the deductible, not a deduction. So the deductible
I said that insurance. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. As long as we're all talking about the same thing.
Air of the tongue.
So
okay, Representative Backer.
Madam Chair. So Representative Backer, so the individual can go ahead and access their drug benefit, and whatever that out-of-pocket cost is for the drug benefit portion would be divided over 12. Now, if they went to the hospital and had further care, their deductible would kick in at that time, but they wouldn't have to pay that deductible up front in order to access their prescription medications. And so they can afford that in January and February. I did have an example that shows that some people who might have a $8,500 cost in their out-of-pocket, instead of paying, $3,600 in January, we'd just have to pay $700 in January, $700 in February, and on through the year, rather than having the $3,600 plus $700 or a portion of that on the top end. And that's what we're trying to avoid, is that cliff of costs that our testifier spoke about.
Thank you.
Representative Backer, okay. So this is sort of a deductible payment plan bill. It just spreads it out to make it more manageable. We wish that it got rid of the deductibles altogether. That's our ultimate goal. But in the meantime, it helps people like Ms. Tice be able to manage to be able to pay. Okay, Representative Damuth and then Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Ms. Tice, for your testimony. I appreciate hearing the story and how this directly affects you. My question is for the bill testifier. Representative Bierman, with the requiring insurers to create these new types of plans, what type of new administrative costs might the insurers be facing?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Certainly they would have the administrative cost of, running their own actuarial values and determining the costs in their areas where they're selling products, and understanding with that patient population over a period of time how many people would buy this plan and making the plan work. But the benefit we have is, we have the federal calculators, we have other states that have calculated this already. So, and the Commerce Department now has done it. And so they're going to have some time to create the, run the numbers and of course, normal marketing advertising to put the plan out there. So exactly what those costs are, I think that would be the same as for any new introduction of a plan that they, presently create in their markets based on changing health economics.
Okay, Representative Damuth?
Nothing further. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, what's the calculated increase required buffer or reserve that would be needed by the entity to cover the, basically this is would be coming from the insurance entity. So they have to be a pool of money. So then January, they'd be able to cover the costs while they were being, paid back, I assume with no interest throughout the year. And so I'm assuming that there would have to have a large percentage larger reserve to not have a cash flow issue. And, so what is that calculation and cost incurred by the entity? What percentage or increase in reserve allowance required? Those kind of details. I'm trying to understand the actual functionality if it was implemented.
So, Representative Bierman, did you make sure that no poor insurance companies will go out of business because of your bill?
Madam Chair, can I clarify?
Representative Quam.
My concern is when we started the Obamacare in Minnesota, we had an entity that was hugely involved and had a very low rate. And once the reimbursement for the loss was gone, they pulled out. It wasn't a viable thing. And I don't want to have us generate something without the forethought and understanding that there could be some issues pop up with this continuing. If we're going to do it, let's do it right so that it will continue throughout the year and next year and et cetera. Because we do have an example in Minnesota where something was implemented and then it wasn't feasible. So that's why part of the state had fewer, they had one option instead of two or three options. And so that's why I'm trying to understand that we went through the appropriate forethought in implementing it and avoid a silly mistake. And that's why I'm hoping the author can alleviate my concerns about not having appropriate forethought, a great intent, but we didn't have this unforeseen thing.
All right. Well, we've heard this bill. This is about the third time we've heard this bill. Representative Bierman, if you can answer just briefly.
Happy to answer, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Quam. And I'm glad you asked the question because when I first looked at this bill, that thought occurred to me as well. I mean, I'm a business person. I extend credit. I understand that paying over time, I thought that there would be a concern from the plans on that. The first insurance company that I reached out to about it said they had other issues that were more important or they were less concerned about that issue, that that wouldn't be such a big deal for them. And that was over a year and a half ago. I'll just have you know that I actually spoke to one last night and I brought up the issue with this insurer as well. And he said, that's not our greatest concern with the bill. So I think that that is a good question, but I didn't seem to receive any feedback that was negative in that regard as far as insurance. So I think we're okay on that.
All right. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author. Is there anything today that would prevent a plan from choosing to offer a plan of this sort?
Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Ackland. There would absolutely be nothing preventing a plan from offering this sort of plan. Absolutely nothing.
My thought was, on the surface sounds like a good plan. Why have they not thought of this?
So,
Representative Bierman.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Ackland. I think that the insurance companies know what's going on all over the country as far as what other states are doing and what other plans are doing. And I think that their reticence to do this is one thing I've heard from the plans is a question about whether the tiers work. The gold, bronze, silver, and gold. Will this work in every area? And there was concern most of last year about that from the plan. So they just didn't think it was practical, feasible to do it. Other areas have shown that it is feasible, and the Commerce Department has certified that this year. So I guess, you know, it's just a matter of they have, you know, they haven't offered this plan in the past simply because what they have, they feel is working, perhaps, for their business model. And sometimes, as we know, we have to nudge things along to get policies that work for consumers, and that's part of what we do, looking out for consumers, looking out for their well-being, not only for their health, but for their financial well-being as well. And we just have to find an arrangement that will work for the companies and our constituents to make health insurance work for everybody.
All right.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And that is my concern. It seems like sort of a common sense solution, but it feels like there is something underneath that hasn't been worked out completely. Otherwise, I don't know why the insurance companies wouldn't adopt such a plan.
Madam Chair, if I may just quickly, you know, just one other issue, Representative Auckland, that we've heard about is their concern about guaranteed renewability of plans, which is a state law here in Minnesota, and that once they make a plan, if they have people who buy it, then they need to keep it. And so when you get too many plans, that may become more cumbersome for them. But I think that's something that, you know, the legislature could look at. And if there is an issue there, we could address it in the future.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. So we are going to, I'm going to just give you a very brief final word, Representative Bierman, and then we're going to take a vote on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I've had the privilege of presenting this numerous times and speaking to members in this committee numerous times about it. So I think we're ready to go ahead and vote. But I would like to again thank Ms. Monica Tice for coming back and testifying again, because, you know, the story that she tells affects thousands of Minnesotans. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. So with that, Representative Bierman renews his motion that House File 633, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you will please take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher. Excused. Representative Ackland. Representative Ackland. Representative Backer.
Backer votes no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
No.
Damuth, no. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
No.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye.
Now, if you could go back to Ackland.
Madam Chair, sorry. Ackland is no.
Ackland, no.
And again, Representative Schultz. Okay, thank you.
All right, there are 10 ayes and 7 nays.
All right, there being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the Motion prevails, and House File 633, the first engrossment as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you again, Representative Bierman and Ms. Tice. Moving on to House Files 3636, Representative Ryer, and Representative Ryer's motion is that House File 3636 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee, and there is an author's amendment. Representative Ryer, did you want to take that up right now?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Ryer moves the A2 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape she'd like to discuss it. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A2 is adopted. And Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You'll all recall that this is the second time this bill has been before us, and we had a thorough walkthrough. It is a DHS Healthcare Administration agency bill focused on a set of 10 policies, and most of them pertain to either the ombudsman statute, cleaning up other language in issues related to annuities, focusing on cleaning up language for foster children, and then telehealth. We're here today to talk about two amendments in particular, though. One is related to repealing the obsolete trust statute, and we are removing that to be in compliance with federal law. The original language of the bill deleted 501C 1206, the public health care programs and certain trust language. The matter that we're still talking about with National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, or NALA, and the Minnesota State Bar Association is keeping one policy paragraph about that, and that it has been added back in. So essentially, that section of the bill, Section 9, has two things in it, a policy statement and then the federal law part, which is being removed. We would like to, in our amendment, put the policy statement in a different section so that we still have that individuals use all available resources to pay for the cost of long-term services. We're working out a couple of last details. We expect to have, we had a productive conversation earlier today, and I expect that to be resolved early next week. So that's one piece of what's changing. The other thing is adding in one more policy piece, which is related to clinical trials, specifying that there are some treatments that would be covered by MA if they were just normal care, routine care for a condition. There are others that are provided as part of a clinical trial. If it's part of a clinical trial, it's not covered by MA. And this adding this in brings it in alignment with the with the federal requirements and is also part of the governor's budget, a no-cost item.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. So I assume that then that because this is going to Ways and Means, you'll probably have a tweak to the language when you get there.
Yes.
In addition to having the fiscal piece reviewed there. So
yes, that's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question either for the author or perhaps for DHS. You mentioned that there was a change to telehealth, and I'm just curious what that encompasses.
Let's see. Representative Ryer, can you take that, or who do we have here from DHS who can answer that for us?
I believe that Ms. Ann Bobst is here and could answer that.
Okay. Ms. Bobst, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ann Bost. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Hopefully you can hear me over my dog in the background as the mail just got here. Representative Morrison, thank you for the question. This proposal in this bill related to telehealth just clarifies some language that was brought to us by our partners in the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Division at DHS to clarify that when they are using accessible video-based telemedicine, which may not use both the audio and visual components, it may just use the visual-only components, but that does count as telemedicine for the purposes of providing the service.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Bops. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. This is for the author. Are any of these changes opposed by a certain group or controversial?
Representative Ryan.
As I mentioned, we are working on that one piece related to the irrevocable trusts with NALA and the Bar Association, and I expect those to be resolved with no issue.
Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remind me what is the issue that you're looking to resolve with them or that needs to be resolved?
Representative Ryan, or should Ms. Bobbs take that one?
I can take a try at it, and I am sure Ms. Bobbs will correct me, but they are concerned about having a policy statement in there that it will be confusing. From my point of view, the language of all available resources is clear, but yet they are concerned about certain phrasing that they think may muddy the waters for people.
Representative Backer?
That's it, thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, if there are no other questions, which I don't see any other questions, Representative Ryer, final word on the bill?
No, I would just say it's a rather dry bill. It covers some important things, and I'm pleased to see it moving forward.
All right, thank you very much for taking this on. So with that, Representative Ryer is going to renew her motion that House File 3636 as amended be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And we will be voting on this, and the chair votes aye. Oh, I'm sorry, wait a minute. Representative Quam has his hand up. Did you have another question, Representative Quam?
Yes, Madam Chair, some clarification. A few years ago, I had a constituent and her wife who do several. They have foster care with several different children, and they had an issue with the county, and they didn't have an ombudsperson. Some of their children are from different races, but there wasn't an ombudsperson for this specific child because they didn't fit into one of the designated categories. Does the fix to the ombudsman make it so that the first thing they say is what is needed, what does the child need, as opposed to what group do you fit into?
Representative Ryer, what does it do to the ombudsman?
That is a very specific question about the ombudsman program, which I would like to defer again to Ms. Bobbs.
Okay, Ms. Bobbs, you thought you're off the hook, but no such luck. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam, for the question. So this provision is related specifically to our managed care ombudsman office, and they help our medical assistance enrollees who are enrolled in a managed care plan, and that's how they receive their health care services. So they help that population. I'm not sure specifically this would address your question related to foster care. But I'm certainly happy to connect you with folks in our Children and Family Services Division who might be able to help with that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Bob. So obviously that's a good question, but not really in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. I had a constituent with some issues, and I didn't want to let this opportunity to ask on that. And thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Back to the roll call. I'm going to renew the motion, or Representative Ryer is going to renew the motion that House File 3636 as amended be re-referred to Ways and Means, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Leeds Schumacher. Excused. Representative Ackland?
Aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer?
Backer holds aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman?
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden?
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damoth?
Aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grinhagen?
Aye.
Grinhagen, aye. Representative Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson?
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor?
Aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam?
Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer?
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott?
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 18 ayes and 0 nays.
Being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you again, Representative Ryer. Okay, House File 4110, Representative Mason, and since Representative Mason is not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 4110 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. To your bill, Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Sandra Mason, and I represent District 51A, and this bill is in response to a problem one of my constituents had, and it involves LASIK surgery, which is a fairly recent procedure, I think. But I think it could be his problem could be an increasing one as people start to age from this procedure. So in the essence of time, I'd like you to hear first from my constituent, Mr. Letourneau.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Letourneau, welcome to the committee. If you would just please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. The story behind House File 4110 is simple. I believe eyes are important. I had cataract surgery at the VA in Minneapolis. The VA is my primary care provider. I'm a Marine Vietnam vet, retired from the Minnesota Air National Guard. The VA doctor asked if I could provide the records from the LASIK surgery. I had the LASIK surgery when I was 51. I called the LASIK doctor, I called their office and were told they were long ago thrown out. They were only required to keep them for 7 years. The VA doctor did the surgery and the results were not great. As a result, they sent me to the U of M to be fitted with contacts because as soon as a contact was applied, my vision was 20/20. After measuring at least 3 times and ordering 3 different contacts, they said the astigmatism was too great for contacts. After a long exam, they came up with a refraction for glasses. The VA doctor stated that it would have been helpful to see the surgical notes and record of LASIK surgery. I had the surgery when I was 71. I have a daughter-in-law who works with a major gastroenterology group. She said they could pull up a colonoscopy from 1996. They keep records basically forever. And calling and asking for help from medical doctors, I called the VA. The doctor, while sympathetic, was unable to testify because of VA protocols. I was similarly unable to get a doctor from the University of Minnesota to testify on short notice for the hearing. I called the Minnesota Academy of Ophthalmology anticipating help. Instead, they sent a letter of opposition, which you probably have in your file. And they, in their letter, they made no mention of serving the patient, only mentioning that patients can request their records. People don't always understand that the records might be important in 40 years or have a place to keep them for so long. They go on to include many other practices that don't keep records for a longer period. Perhaps the bill needs to be expanded because other people operate on ICE. They made no mention of protection for the patients. It took me 3 years to pay off the LASIX bill for the surgery. I think the doctor could have afforded to save the records. Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for allowing me to take your time this afternoon.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Letourneau. So are there any questions or discussion from the committee? Representative Boland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question for the author. I'm wondering, just curious, as I'm reading the bill, I think I'm seeing that it would require the saving the records for 60 years. I'm just curious if that is consistent with other practices, with other types of medical providers, or how did you arrive at that number, maybe?
Representative Mason.
Thank you very much. As you heard, for the colonoscopy, they keep that for, sounds like forever. And what the reason, we did do some research on this, but what the bill is trying to do is thinking about when people normally get the LASIK surgery versus when they get the cataract surgery or later surgery. So that's why it's like my daughter had it, the surgery, and I'm thinking that was almost 20 years ago, but she's still going to have probably another 10 years or so before she go, probably hopefully more than 10, before she gets to the cataract one. So the deal is to make sure people have the information early on. And actually, I mean, the state does keep certain records. For instance, it does keep maintained data on immunizations that people have received over the years. So this, as I said, I can't think of many things that are more important than your eyes. So the fact that typically they only keep the records for 7 years, I think is unacceptable, knowing that most of us are going to have future eye surgeries later on. Does that answer your question? And I know South Dakota, for instance, they have a 10-year storage program. But again, that doesn't help people that have had LASIK surgery and will have the further eye surgery later on.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Ackland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, just thank you for your service. And my concern, actually, Representative Boland addressed it, is that this is narrowing this down to one particular type of surgeon, an ophthalmologist, et cetera. And so my question was, it seems to me that when I worked in the hospital, you know, medical records had, you know, there were state laws for keeping any medical record. And so to me, this issue is probably more than just eye surgery. This is an issue for any kind of surgery that a person has. How long should those records be kept? And I think part of this issue goes back to before we were electronic, when we had paper records and everything was, you had to go to the medical records department and pull a file. So I think that we could make a bill that would increase retention of medical records easily now to include not just eye surgeons. So just a comment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ackland. It sounds like you've got your next project.
Thank you.
Representative Backer.
Yeah. To me, this bill seems to be needed to be seen, and no fun there, but seen by the Judicial Committee because it relates to database and record keeping. And this is to the author or maybe to the chair, will be referred to judicial, and can, if it is referred to judicial, can it meet the deadline?
Well, Representative Backer, the bill is being laid over, but actually I would disagree that it would need to go to judiciary anyway. It's not I can't speak for the chair. I mean, we could always check with her to see if she wanted to see it, but this is not about transferring data at all. It's about just how long the keeper of it keeps it. So to me, this doesn't, I do serve on that committee. I served on it for a number of years. It doesn't seem to me like the kind of issue they would need to see, but thanks for flagging that. But our plan is to lay it over today.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That I know, but anytime you start to collect data, that can get into a touchy area. So it's a suggestion, and I appreciate you taking that suggestion.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Representative Becker. We're not, this isn't about collecting any new data. This is about data that is collected or created, actually, and how long it should be kept by the keeper of it. So, not seeing any other hands. So very brief closing, Representative Mason, before we lay the bill over.
Okay. Yes, I just wanted to mention the fact that the current record times, like 7 years, one of the options would be to ask the provider to contact the patient. But I'm thinking in our mobile society, that might not be always an easy thing to do. That's why the bill is looking at a more substantial way of somebody collecting it, like the state that we know is going to be there. Again, I appreciate your time and thoughts, and we'll definitely be contacting some of you in the future. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mason. So with that, House File 4110 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So we have Representative Jordan with us, and she is bringing House File 3873. So the chair will move that House File 3873 be re-referred to the General Register. And Representative Jordan, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. You've already heard this bill from me, so I am here once again to talk about House File 3873, which is an agency bill that would enable MDH to develop rules consistent with the federal Renovate, Repair, and Paint, or RRP rule. To briefly refresh your memories, the bill makes a number of policy changes that were discovered in the course of developing MDH's RRP rule. The first change addresses differences between the lead abatement and RRP thresholds. Currently, we are not in compliance with federal standards here, and this change will alleviate confusion among lead-certified firms submitting lead hazard reduction notifications to the department. The second part of this proposal addresses the primary intent issue with regard to lead hazard reduction and renovation work in residences and child occupied facilities. To accomplish this, we would move back to the original lead law language from pre-2009 regarding primary intent and place it under the revised definition of lead hazard reduction. The third part of this proposal revises the definition of a certified renovation firm so that it is aligned with the federal RRP standard. This is mostly a housekeeping bill, but for questions I have today with me, our asbestos and lead compliance supervisor at MDH to answer questions that anyone may have about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Jordan. There is one testifier, Nick Erickson. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nick Erickson. I'm the Director of Research and Regulatory Affairs for Housing First Minnesota. And for the past 5 years, I've been the housing industry's point person on the agency's effort to adopt a lead paint rule. And I know it's Friday on deadline week, so I will be as brief as possible. The dangers and health effects of lead paint are well understood by Housing First Minnesota and our members. No one understands this danger clearer than those contractors who day in and day out are working in a situation where lead paint is present. Our concerns with this bill are rooted in the department's move to adopt its own lead paint RRP rule, which does govern the renovation of pre-1978 homes. The department has been working on more than 5 years and has yet to present a rule that is considered workable by remodelers and renovators. And this bill was presented without stakeholder input. We feel that it would be best for the department to wait until a final version of the bill, the rule has been presented to stakeholders, and we can work through anything in the stakeholder process related to its provisions before state statute is changed so the rule may be adopted. With that, I can stand for any questions and let you get back to the hearing.
Thank you very much, Mr. Erickson. So, Representative Jordan, I don't know if you wanted to respond or you wanted someone from the Department of Health to respond.
I think it would be better for MDH to respond.
Okay. And welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Daniel Lasher, L-O-C-H-R, spelling the last name, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health, Asbestos Lead Compliance Unit. In response to the question posed from Mr. Erickson, I do understand your concerns. During a stakeholder meeting in September last year, we did talk about this, making the changes during a rulemaking, a stakeholder meeting with respect to the actual rulemaking process. And these issues were identified 3 years ago. Actually, it's not the first time we discussed this. This goes back to House File 2008. And these are things we've actually been trying to work through at the statute level so that we're able to effectively move forward with RRP rulemaking. The comments received during the stakeholder meeting most recently were to have alignment with the federal standard for the Renovate, Repair, Paint Rule RRP. And I'm not sure what more I can say about this other than we're continuing to work on that. Right now, we have a final draft version of the rule that's undergoing legal review. And so the comment period is still open. So we're willing to have further discussions on that to ameliorate your concerns.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lasher. So any questions or comments from the committee? All right, not seeing any. Final word, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for your time. I appreciate your support on this bill.
All right, so with that, House File 38, I will renew my motion that House File 3873 be referred to the General Register. Ms. Niedernhoff, if you would take the roll, and the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Lead Schumacher, excused. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, no.
Grunhagen, no. Representative Keel.
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, no.
Munson, no. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
No.
Quam, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 14 ayes and 4 nays.
All right, there being 14 ayes and 4 nays, House File 3873 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Jordan and testifiers. Okay. So let's see. Next, I believe we are moving to Representative Vang. And okay, so Representative Vang is here, I assume. I think I saw her. And she has House File 4113. Representative Bang, are you here? Okay, I think she is not here. So we'll skip that one. And we will go on. Let's see. Okay, you know what, members? We were scheduled to take a short break here. And even though maybe it's fortuitous, I guess, while we wait for Representative Vang. So we're gonna take a 10-minute break so that we can get up and move around a little bit and staff can have a brief break. So let's say it's now 2:54, so let's come back at 3:05. We will reconvene at 3:05. We are in recess. To order, We've had a 10-minute recess, and I understand that Representative Bang is here. Representative Bang?
I'm here, she is. Madam Chair.
Yes, welcome to the committee. So Representative Bang is here with House File 4113. So the chair will move that House File 4113 be re-referred to the General Register. So Representative Vang, could you go ahead and explain what your bill does?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a pretty straightforward bill. It builds off on the work of retaining mental health providers in the workforce from last year. This bill amends a session law to allow MDH to use current funding for a program to also be used to pay for supervision costs to become a supervisor if needed, and also to start paying for supervision costs for those seeking to become mental health professionals. We've often been told that finding supervision is a barrier for mental health professionals. This will help reduce the gap for getting more supervisors in to train the next workforce. So that's what the bill is, and I will yield my time. I believe there are staff on hand from MDH to also help answer any questions too.
All right. Very, very good. Thank you, Representative Vang. Are there any questions from members? All right, not seeing any. Oh, we got Representative Pryor.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to make a quick comment and thank Representative Vang for this excellent bill. We are addressing such a critical need right now. And so this is just a way of streamlining the process and making it better for everybody. So it's a great bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. All right. And I also would like to thank Representative Vang. This is part of a package of work that she's been doing to try to remove barriers to get more people, especially diverse people, diverse practitioners into our mental health system. So really important stuff. Representative Backer.
I am unmuted now. Thank you, Chair. My question is to what type of, first of all, we all support with mental health. That's very important. I get that. But specifically on this program, what type of early success have we seen with these grants? Thank you.
Representative Bank.
Madam Chair, I think it will be best to defer this to staff from MDH who probably have measurements on and can see the kind of demand that we have for addressing this need in mental health.
Okay. Let's see. Who do we have here from the department that could address this? Okay. Mr. Radosovic, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Backer, I don't have numbers to give to you today. We will collect them, but the bill has the initial program has the RFP has been responded to, and we have the applications in hand. But we know that there's from other research, we know that there is a growing need for the supervision costs to be covered for the base bill itself. We're just collecting that information now.
Okay, Representative Backer?
Nothing further.
Okay, and Ms. Radosovic, the staff tells me I need your name for the record, if you could just state your name and title.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Zora Radosovic, Director of Rural Health and Primary Care in the Minnesota Department of Health.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And now you know that everybody knows that the staff are watching me to make sure I do everything correctly. Representative Vang, any further closing words? I'm not seeing any other questions. So,
no, I just want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee members for this time and for consideration of this bill. It's a good bill. It makes sense to address our needs here after it's been exacerbated with the pandemic and COVID-19. And so there is definitely urgency to continue to address this workforce issue. So thank you so much for your support.
All right. Thank you very much. And so with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion that House Bill 4113 be re-referred to the General Register. Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would take the roll, please. And the chair votes aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt.
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Leeds Schumacher. Excused. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Representative Bonner.
Bonner, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Damuth.
Aye.
Damuth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Representative Munson.
Munson, aye.
Munson, aye. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, aye.
Pryor, aye. Representative Quam.
Yes. Yes.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Wolgamott, aye. There are 18 ayes and 0 nays.
There being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you again, Representative Vang. So we will now go to House File 4504, Representative Morrison. And Representative Morrison's motion is that House Bill 4504 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And then, Representative Morrison, did you want to move your author's amendment right now?
I would like to move the author's amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. So let's adopt the author's amendment then. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted and to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, House File 4504 is a bill to modify provisions of the Drug Price Transparency Act, the bipartisan effort that became law during the 2020 session. The high and ever-rising price of prescription drugs has been a concern of most Minnesotans for some time. As has been noted in this committee and in homes around the state, drugs don't work if people can't afford them. Part of the frustration around the high price of drugs is the opacity that exists around how and why they are priced the way they are. The public, the legislature, and payers have virtually no insights into the price-setting practices in the industry or the factors that drive price increases. The Drug Price Transparency Act was born of that frustration, and the bipartisan support for it reflected Minnesotans' desire to better understand why drugs are priced the way they are, and perhaps to aid policymakers once it was better understood so that drugs could become more affordable for the people that rely on them to be healthy and in some cases to survive. Under the new law, manufacturers must report information that MDH will make available to the public when drug prices exceed certain thresholds at introduction or rise above certain thresholds. This law will help us learn about international prices, direct costs associated with marketing, manufacturing, and distribution, revenue and net profits, and what factors manufacturers say drives pricing. The reporting requirement began on January 1st of this year, and for the period through January 15th, MDH has already recorded reports by 50 manufacturers covering nearly 420 drugs for reportable price increases and new introductions, and most of these for drugs where the price increased. MDH will begin making public reported information in April and will report to the legislature by May 15th. This bill makes technical changes identified by MDH in developing the reporting guidance with feedback from manufacturers. That needs technical fixes and clarifications include adding definitions and related language that support the identification of drugs, clarifying the time period associated with reporting for some data elements,
and aligning reporting across subdivisions by making clear that reporting covers biosimilar drugs. And though the law was a major step forward for Minnesota to begin bringing some drug price transparency, they've already identified a number of weaknesses about this approach. Minnesota only receives list prices, which are not what consumers and health plans must actually pay for the drugs. And as manufacturers point out, the focus only on manufacturers means we don't have a full understanding of the impact of pricing decisions across the supply chain, including wholesalers, PBMs, and pharmacies. So this directs MDH to collect two data elements that will let us calculate the net prices for drugs, the total volume of rebates and the number of drug units sold. This will allow us to understand for which drugs, drug classes, and market conditions increases in list prices are just an outcome of rising rebates demanded by PBMs. In that case, the net price may actually fall, and when net prices rise due to the pricing power of manufacturers. Thank you for your attention, Madam Chair and members. MDH is also here for any technical questions members may have.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Morrison. Are there questions from members? All right. I'm not seeing any. With that, then, I don't know if you want to say anything more, Representative Morrison. It sounds like you kind of said all you needed to say.
I think so, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. With that, then, House File 4504, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. Now we have some bills with Representative Schultz. So Representative Schultz is moving that House File 4572 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health Finance Bill. And no amendment, I don't think. So Representative Schultz, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And House File 4572 are technical updates to our assisted living licensure bill that we passed successfully with bipartisan support. I'm going to have MDH explain the bill.
Okay, who do we have here from the department to explain the bill? All right, welcome. Please give us your name and your title and go ahead and let us know what the bill is doing.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Krieger, and I am a program manager within the Health Regulation Division. So in regards to the bill in front of us today, as Representative Schultz mentioned, assisted living licensure was passed in 2019 with broad bipartisan support and stakeholder support as well. Prior to the implementation on August 1st, the department drafted and passed rules that accompanied this licensure. The department also engaged in robust stakeholder conversation on how to best operationalize assisted living licensure. And while many changes were made ahead of the implementation, several areas remained unresolved. In addition, new needs have emerged from the process of implementation as we try out the new licensure in the months leading from assisted living licensure on August 1st. So the department recommendations include revisions to diversify the home care and assisted living program advisory council membership and size to include representation from assisted living providers and stakeholders, specifically making sure that there is that representation from assisted living providers and stakeholders. Adding the definition of serious injury to the chapter for resident protection and maltreatment prevention purposes. Permit the department to review license application compliance history in other states and for healthcare license types similar to Minnesota's assisted living and home care licensures before issuing an applicant a license. Prohibit a licensee from license renewals unless they have served recipients under their licensure in a specific time period. Permit a change of ownership concept without the need of specific administration burden on licenses or unlicensees or residents. At the request of the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, creating a parity where their office desired to be listed as a resource to residents alongside the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. require the licensee to be responsible for agents of the facility if they are not employees or other officials of the facility, working to clarify fines, enforcement actions, and correction order procedures to align with department processes, creating consistency between the chapter and its related rule regarding emergency relocations, clarifying the duties of the facility in the situation of reduction of services or elimination of services, requiring dementia experience for day-to-day officials operating assisted living facilities, and prohibit the use of restraints for the purpose of discipline or convenience within the facilities. That concludes my portion of the review, and so I'll turn it back over.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that information. Are there any questions from members? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at this, I'm wondering, Section 35 requires that the applicants, the assisted living director has to, managerial office officer and clinical nurse supervisor all have to have experience with dementia to be employed. Or employ a consult. I'm just wondering with the licensure, the requirements for people right now hiring, is that really necessary? And why would it be necessary? Let's put it that way. And then I'm just concerned that we're gonna have a hard time hiring people to put that in when you have staff that has a little bit more exposure to dementia, not necessarily everybody have that qualification. I'm wondering if that's necessary.
Oh. Sorry, Representative Keel. Ms. Krueger.
What's that?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel. In regards to your question, I understand that there are staffing challenges, especially right now with COVID. How we have the language worded, and we're definitely open to more conversation, is in regards to the safety and making sure that those who are closest to providing care and services of the residents have the necessary training, education, and understanding for these residents who are most vulnerable with a diagnosis of dementia. As a reminder, is that what we have as far as the language is that we've struck out applicant and inserted in the assisted living director, managerial, and clinical nurse supervisor. This would be for all new licenses coming in, and it would be something that they would be aware of prior to applying for assisted living licensure with a dementia care license.
Thank you. So if I was a sitting director, then I wouldn't have to have that requirement. But if I were new coming in as a assisted living director, then I would be required to have that background.
Ms. Krueger.
Madam Chair, Representative, just to clarify the question, are you asking if it's a brand new director coming in regards to somebody who has been in the business for some time?
Yes.
Yeah.
So in regards to that question, I think it goes back to if you have been in a director situation for some time, it would just be if you had experience with managing residents with dementia. And if you did have that experience, it wouldn't be something that would be new to go out and obtain additional education. But for those who are coming in new that do not have experience with managing residents with dementia, that would be something that is required.
Representative
Keel. Madam Chair, thank you. You know, I have some real concerns about this, and Representative Schultz, Chair Schultz, my concern would be is if we're going to go this far in requirements, and I understand. I worked with a lot of dementia people, and there's something about knowing how to handle somebody in that situation. I just think this is going to be very difficult for us to retain directors, especially those who are getting to the end of their careers. They've had a lot of experience. They usually have worked through the chain of care that I see in my world. And I just really
I think we're going to make it difficult to be able to hire, and it's going to make it much more difficult to run these assisted living facilities. We certainly want everybody to be protected, and it is a task to understand somebody and work with someone who has dementia. But someone who is moving into an assisted living situation doesn't necessarily need all that background. They just are looking for some kind of care. Families looking for them to have a little more supervision than just living independently on their own. And so, while I can appreciate the direction, I think we got to be careful how far we go with this, because people are not looking for assisted living to be that tightly controlled. And I ask seniors all the time that have moved into assisted living, and they don't even always appreciate being checked on. However, that is part of being in assisted living. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And Ms. Kruger, I understood that you were talking about people who were going to be in dementia care facilities. Am I correct on that?
Yes, that is correct. That's specific to the assisted living with dementia care license.
Right. So it's not. So Representative Peel, this is not for the general assisted living. This is if you have a dementia care license. So you're going to be taking care of people with dementia by definition. So that's what this is about. Okay.
Correct, Madam Chair. I apologize.
I knew you didn't realize so.
But yeah. No, I we have those facilities where the director is for everything. And so that's my concern. Nursing.
Yeah.
Whole work. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay, other questions from members? All right, not seeing any. So Ms. Kruger, thank you very much. Representative Schultz, did you have any closing comment?
I don't, Chair Liebling, and I will meet with Representative Keel to address concerns since this is being laid over.
All right, thank you. So with that, House File 4572 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Okay, Representative Schultz now has House File 4573, and her motion is that House File 4573 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And Representative Schultz, to your bill, 4573.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. This is brought forward by a study that had been conducted on VBR and change of ownership on quality in nursing homes. So there's been a lot of change of ownership. I know many academics in Minnesota that have been working on this and evaluating this, and we did our own study, and I'm not going to go through that today because we need to get out of here on time, but this is good legislation, and I will have MDH explain the details.
All right, thank you, and welcome to the committee. If you would introduce yourself, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Shalee Dietrich. I work at MDH, the Health Regulation Division, and I am the Federal Operations Manager for Licensing, Certification, and Registration. The Minnesota Department of Health proposes changes to Minnesota Statute Chapter 144A related to state licensure of nursing homes regarding change of ownerships to bring state requirements in line with existing federal change of ownership requirements and processes. Legislative changes in 2016 provided a change of nursing home reimbursement. The change to value-related reimbursement shortly thereafter was a significant increase in change of ownerships for nursing homes in the state. Many new owners of Minnesota nursing homes were buyers outside of the state of Minnesota, with complex ownership structures making it almost impossible to identify who truly was responsible for the operation of the facility. Unfortunately, nationally and now shown here in Minnesota, the increase in chows for nursing facilities is followed by a downward trend of quality and safety indicators for residents of those facilities. The department proposes using the federal Medicare CMS 855 form, an already federally required form for the federal change of ownership process, as a starting point for the state change of ownership proposal. This form was already familiar to nursing home providers. This proposal then creates the necessary state licensing and enforcement requirements language to effectuate. The change of ownership concept proposal borrows from the successful implementation of the state same concept within the assisted living licensor under Chapter 144G. Many of the terms, language, and detailed discussion regarding the best approach for the concept of change of ownerships. The department has consulted with and worked closely with the Department of Human Services, provider organizations, and offices of Benjamin for long-term care regarding this change. Excuse me. And on another note, I've been working with change of ownerships for, probably 20 years. And within the last couple of years, they're more and more complex. It's hard to figure out who's actually in charge of the operation. You'll receive like a legal entity, and then like five entities down is like the controlling person. So it's really hard to determine. So that is why we are proposing this change in this language.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dietrich.
Yes. I'm sorry. Having a throat thing right now. So.
It's okay. Well, we've got a question coming. I hope you can find some water close by.
I know. And I have a drink or something.
Okay, sure. Go ahead. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And excuse me, my turn now. Have any transfers occurred in the recent years to ownership groups that would not have been licensed had this been law?
Ms. Dietrich.
There possibly could have, because now we're also looking to see if the controlling persons or the managerial agents had misdemeanors, felonies. That is going to be part of the change. And maybe that would have denied some change of ownerships. I'm not sure, because we didn't have the opportunity to look into that.
Representative Backer.
And then that would be helpful, because I get it. We are all on the same page. We want the best care for our seniors. But
yes.
What I want to make sure, Madam Chair and everybody, is that we are investing our resources down the right pipeline, if I could use that as a word. One last question here. The bill requires license applications to include statistical information required by MDH. Help me understand what specific stats you're looking for, what will be required. My concern is, if this becomes law, next year there could be some stats that would be required, but 5 years from now there will be more and more, and what started to grow as a small list becomes a big list. So if you could help me out with that, that'd be much appreciated.
Ms. Dietrich.
I actually thank you for the question, and we're still reviewing that piece of it. If it's okay, if we could get back to you on that.
Well, the bill will be laid over. Representative Backer.
Okay.
Yeah, it will be laid over. Yeah, that would be good. Again, you know, I get it. You got to work on something, but one of the things that I hear over the years from my nursing homes in the area, healthcare centers, which they do a great job in 12A, is they're spending more and more time on paperwork and less time with the patient. I remember when I began my volunteer gig 27 years ago that we had one or two pieces of paper. Now when we do a hospital transfer, it's like a small book. And then we got to give a copy to the hospital. We keep one. Now, I know this is something different, but it seems like in this area that paperwork is getting more and more. I understand that we want the best possible care, because we don't want patients to be neglected. So that would be very helpful if you could help me define or what you're looking for. Maybe we put that in the bill, too, to be more specific. So thank you. Thank you there.
Mm-hmm. And then if I can just add also, I'm sorry, I mentioned the CMS 855 form. Providers are filling that out currently, but we don't see the results of that form till after the chow has occurred. So that's where we're trying to get that language in place at the start when we're receiving that license application, just to another note.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Dietrich. I mean, part of keeping people safe in nursing facilities is making sure that the owners of the nursing facilities are on the up and up.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So I assume that is why we don't let people with certain criminal convictions, for example, buy a nursing home, correct?
Right.
So
yes.
This is about protecting our most vulnerable patients. And
absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Ms. Dietrich.
Yep.
Any closing comment, Representative Schultz?
No, but I'm happy to work with Representative Backer on the language along with MDH. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. With that, House File 4573 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So we will now move to House File 1516, another Representative Schultz bill. And the motion on this one, again, is that House File 1516 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And this is, again, a bill that we've heard before, but there is a DE4 amendment that I believe represents some work that's been done by the advocates in the meantime. Did you want to move the DE4, Representative Schultz?
Yes, Chair Liebling, I'd like to move the DE4, please.
All right. So we will take a vote on the DE4. All in favor of adoption of the DE4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the DE4 is adopted. So, Representative Schultz, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. This is a bill that was brought forward by a constituent, David Spurl, a PharmD at Essentia Healthcare. And it's a way to create more competition between biologics and biosimilars, which are the generic form of a biologic. And we worked on this legislation with Eric Tichy at the Mayo Clinic, and it's gone through several rounds because we're working with as many stakeholders as possible. But these are very, very expensive drugs. And so we're trying to reduce the expense because people who have chronic conditions, often arthritis, other diseases, really depend on and rely on biologics and biosimilars. And in the U.S., we just haven't done a very good job of reducing those barriers to have more biosimilars introduced in the market compared to European countries. So I think there's a lot more to do. So members, I really do urge you to support this amendment and the underlying bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schultz. And so the first testifier I have, I think what we need, I'm not sure who is supposed to be first here, but we need someone to kind of explain the changes from the last version. And I don't know, is that Dr. Spurl who could do that? Welcome.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yeah, Chair Liebling. Thank you so much and committee members. I'm David Spurl. For the record, Senior Director of Acute Care Pharmacy at Essentia Health and a pharmacist living in Duluth. And I'm grateful for this opportunity to offer support for the amendment and the legislation that's combined additional expertise from a multitude of stakeholders working on this bill. So we support this amendment as it strengthens the robust wording of the proposed legislation to reduce cost by opening up competition. And specifically, this amendment sets up a progressive structure for offering equivalent coverage for these equivalent medications to drive costs. So the amendment really looked towards those biosimilars that were in early market stage and those having complete parity across the board. And then as they went on and more medications were added, then it would really work to continue to change that preference fully over to the biosimilar. So really looking for a progressive stage that meets the market there. And again, We are confident that this equivalent coverage for those equivalent medications will drive competition forward. The current system set up by medical and pharmacy benefit managers and the brand manufacturers, as Representative Schultz said, has limited the ability for patients to benefit from these biosimilar medications. reducing waste and costs in the healthcare system is often broadly cited as an aspirational goal. This House File 1516 and proposed amendment accomplish both of those aspirations. So we respectfully request your support of this amendment.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Spurl. I have also a Brett Michelin. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Brett Michelin with the Association for Accessible Medicines. AAM represents the generic and biosimilar manufacturers, and we are happy to support this amendment. I do want to thank all of the parties also, those that have mentioned, and I think Dr. Spurl and others will be testifying, but also recognize the work that Representative Schultz and Senator Nelson have put into this. I don't think we've seen any other state work as hard on this issue as Minnesota has already provided. I do want to recognize a couple of the points in the bill, and it's really two primary provisions that lead us to support it. And one, it is creating the incentive for biosimilars to compete against each other with lower costs as they do move from parity once there's at least two on the market requiring equivalent coverage to once the third biosimilar comes to market, allowing them to compete and drive down costs. And that is what will save money for patients in the long run. Biosimilars have already proven to be effective, have been used in over 121 million patient therapy days. They're projected to save over $130 billion by 2025 alone. I do want to give one quick example of why this bill is needed. And it comes from a real life experience that the country has witnessed that began in late 2021 when the first biosimilar insulin was introduced to the market. It was introduced at a 65% discount from the reference product. However, it wasn't picked up much. There was very little sales. It got very little market access. The company that produced it took it back to the drawing board, introduced a new branded version of the same drug, put it onto the market for a very minimal reduction, offered a large rebate, and suddenly that's when the PBMs and the insurers decided to pick it up and put it out to the public. That's what we are trying to avoid in this truly developing market. There's a lot of uncertainty. It is very new. There's, I believe we're at about 21 biosimilars that are currently on the market. And so we do support this amendment and do thank the state of Minnesota and the senator and representative for really driving this issue and for those who have worked on us as we do find how this market is going to develop. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michelin. And I have Dr. Eric Tishy is here from Mayo. Welcome.
Madam Chair and Committee, I would also like to recognize Representative Schultz and Senator Nelson for their innovation and support of this legislation. I would like to also extend off of Mr. Michelin's comments that, this really addresses an important need. You know, increasing use of biosimilars is really the most powerful tool we have to reduce drug costs. And one of the biggest challenges is that this rebate system keeps drug prices up front very high so that changing drug costs never benefit the patient. Studies, including our own experience at Mayo Clinic, have shown that the biggest barriers to increasing biosimilar use in clinics and hospitals is healthcare provider reluctance, and then insurance plans that require specific and often higher cost products, such as the branded product. House File 1516 will ensure parity of insurance coverage for biosimilar drugs, which will smooth the process for healthcare providers ordering biosimilar versions of drugs rather than branded drugs. House File 1516 will also increase patient access to biosimilars by preventing health plans from requiring the use of higher cost branded products. At Mayo Clinic, we take a biosimilars first approach that covers biosimilars at parity for our own health plan. And we also prefer the use of biosimilars for our patients that we take care of that are not on our own health plan. We have encountered examples where insurance providers require the use of brand drugs that are sometimes as much as three times more expensive than the biosimilar alternative that we would prefer to use for our patients. So Mandating use of higher cost drugs inflates drugs prices and exposes patients to higher healthcare costs. And I think we all share the mission to make healthcare more accessible and more affordable. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr. Tishy. I have Michelle Mack. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Mack, and I'm a senior director at the Pharmaceutical Care Management Association, PCMA. PCMA is the national trade organization for the pharmacy benefit managers. I'm here today to respectfully testify in opposition to House File 1516. PCMA has testified in opposition to this bill a few times over the last 3 years, and our position has not changed, so I won't reiterate all those points. However, I just do want to say that while Senator Schultz's amendment is a move in the right direction from the original language, we still feel that this will not lead to an increased use of biosimilars, which in turn would not lower costs to consumers. House File 1516 expressly limits PBM tools, such as formulary development and management, specifically to biosimilars, effectively hamstringing PBMs and plans where these tools are needed most. The one thing that has changed and has been noted in this space is that there is now on the market an interchangeable biosimilar. And just FYI, an interchangeable biosimilar is much like a generic change can be made right at the pharmacy, unlike a biosimilar because they are a competing brand. And we expect more interchangeable biosimilars to be available in the market in 2023. I do want to make a note that we drive to the lowest net cost. That is why we are hired. And much like the Department of Health does for the Medicaid department in Minnesota, sometimes the branded drug is the lowest net cost than the a biosimilar or a generic. Just to close, the biosimilar and interchangeable biosimilar markets are in their infancy, and the existing incentive structure will drive them to get more efficient in their manufacturing capabilities and thus allow them to compete on price, just as happened with the generics over the previous decades. Thanks for your time and consideration, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mack. Are there questions? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I want to thank Representative Schultz for bringing this bill forward and all the work that she's been doing on this over the years. And I think there's a real attempt to find ways to lower costs for consumers. You know, I guess here's where I am going to profess my frustration. If PBMs are hired to provide the lowest cost, and we're clearly not making that mission, and that discount is not being passed on to the consumers, then would that not mean that you are actually failing at your mission? I don't know that that's a good reason to oppose lower-cost alternative drugs. If that is really your mission, then wouldn't you want to encourage lower-cost drugs in the marketplace that actually get to consumers? And I'm really not understanding the point of that, and I will tell you, just in all disclosure, and then I will let it go, but before coming to the legislature, I worked for a PBM, and even within working for a PBM, I can tell that even internally, they realize that consumers are continuing to get more and more angry and more frustrated with the rebate system, and they want it gone. So either PBMs need to figure out how to make their value known and actually make sure that those discounts get to the actual consumer, or no offense, but get out of the marketplace.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I think you speak for many of us. Representative Backer.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry. Sometimes it takes a while to unmute it. Anyway, so my first question to the author, does this bill exempt public programs and SEGIP
Representative Schultz.
Chair Liebling and Representative Backer, at one point, I believe it did in an amendment, but the current version does not. But, you know, we're going to keep working on it since it'll be laid over.
Representative Backer. I think you mean CGIP. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
What was that again?
S-E-G-I-P. We usually
S-E-G-I-P.
Yeah.
Sam, Indiana. I mean, right. Sam and that's Edward, George.
Right. That's what we call CGIP. That's our state's insurance program.
So if they are not exempt, I'm assuming we'll see a fiscal note for the bill's impact on those programs?
Yes, Chair Liebling, yes. It's being worked on in process, Representative Backer.
Okay.
Yeah. And we have the amendment, of course, today, adopted today. Okay, other questions? All right, seeing no further questions, Representative Schultz renews her motion that House File 1516 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill, and the bill is laid over. So thank you, Representative Schultz, and thank you, testifiers. Next up, we have Representative Freiberg with House File 3280. And Representative Freiberg, and I should say, members, this is information only. We don't actually have possession of the bill, so there's no motion here to move a bill. But there is an amendment, and the reason that we brought it back up is to discuss the amendment, because this bill could very well show up in the omnibus bill. And so the amendment is the A2 author's amendment. And so I will turn it over to Representative Freiberg to discuss the bill with the proposed amendment. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your continued interest in this legislation. I won't rehash everything. I'll just kind of describe, since we had testimony, I described it and we had testimony on it a few weeks ago. But the amendment is an attempt to address some of the concerns that were raised in the previous hearing. Just to remind the committee about the issue, under a white bagging arrangement, insurance companies force drugs to be purchased through an insurer's exclusive specialty pharmacy choice. The drugs are then shipped to a physician's office or hospital facility for administration to a specific patient. This multi-step process interrupts the normal course of treatment and blocks providers' ability to deliver the best possible care and service to their patients. This restricts patient and physician choice, harms patient safety, delays patient care, and increases the cost of care. So as I mentioned, the amendment addresses concerns raised by payers at the previous hearing in two ways. First of all, it gives the plans, the health carriers, and the PBMs time to implement the bill's requirements by changing the effective date of the bill to 2023. Second, the amendment deletes language objected to by payers. Removing this language means PBMs and health insurers could reimburse their owned and affiliated pharmacies more than contracted network pharmacies. This means the plans and insurers can continue to allow spread pricing as a cost containment tool. So I do have one testifier here to speak to the amendment, and there are a couple here available to answer questions. So I'd like to turn it over to the testifier.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Freiberg. And Scott, you're going to need to say your last name for me again, but welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Scott Sefci. I am the Director of Pharmacy Cancer Care Services at the Mayo Clinic. And this amendment is designed to approach some of the concerns we had in our previous hearing, in which the plans were concerned with their abilities to negotiate contracts, et cetera. It removes the restriction that the payers could not pay their own pharmacies more than that they could pay a provider. I want to remind the committee that there is nothing in this bill that prevents payers from negotiating contracts. There is nothing in this bill that prevents payers from negotiating a white bagging proposition. What we are asking for is, in the situation as it stands now, in the status quo, that the payer may not mandate a white bagging without discussions and negotiations with the providers. And that's the situation we're currently seeing. And that is what's causing significant harm to patients, also causing cost shifting to patients, so increase into the patient care or the patient out-of-pocket care. So we believe this is a nice compromise with this bill, and we would help this bill move forward and protect our patients and be to the best interest of our patients.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Sefji. And so now we will go to Ms. Mack, and she will tell us why it's not good enough. Ms. Mack, welcome back.
Good afternoon again. Michelle Mack, Senior Director at PCMA. We appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony at the second informational hearing on House File 3280. We provided in-depth testimony at the first informational hearing on March 1st, and therefore I will be brief given it is late in the afternoon. We have reviewed the A2 amendment, and we appreciate Representative Freiberg's removal of Subdivision 4-3. However, we still feel the bill prohibits an employer, a plan, or a PBM to have an option to get a drug from an alternative source, and it prohibits clinical administered drugs from being covered as a pharmacy benefit. Therefore, we are still opposed. This is a very complicated bill with the potential for unintended and costly consequences. We believe this should be reviewed in much greater detail and would encourage the author to have the bill reviewed through the Department of Commerce mandate review process and use the findings from that report to make an informed public policy. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Mack. And Dan Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Trade Association for the Nonprofit Insurers in the State. I don't have a lot of information to share on the topic compared to the comments made in the previous hearing, but do want to get on the record that the amendment being discussed does not address our concerns with the bill, and the proponents haven't discussed this with us. The amendment, if the amendment were adopted to the bill, the council would remain opposed because it doesn't address our main concern with the bill, which is hospital clinic markups under a buy-and-bill arrangement. The language being removed was a prohibition on health plans reducing reimbursements, but with the amendment, the bill is now silent on the issue of reimbursement, meaning hospitals will still be able to continue their practice of markups while prohibiting plans from using white bagging, a practice that can save patients less. Now, as I previously testified, our plans in the fully insured market do not use white bagging. Some may need to turn to this as drug prices continue to increase and hospital and clinic continue to place markups over 200% on these drugs. We've had a lot of discussion in this committee about needing to lower healthcare costs, and we completely agree. But House File 3280, even as potentially amended, puts a future roadblock to health plans seeking ways to lower costs to patients, even though this is not being used in the fully insured market. We're open to discuss this issue with Representative Freiberg and proponents at any time, but as of today, we believe this issue needs significantly more analysis before proceeding further. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Questions from members? So I have a question, if no one else does, and that is, I guess, to Ms. Mack and to Mr. Andreessen. So if you don't like the amendment, do you like the bill better with the amendment or without the amendment? Ms. Mack.
Chair Liebling, as I indicated, we believe this is a step in the right direction. However, this is one small change to a lot of issues that we still have with the bill.
Okay, thank you for that. And Mr. Andreessen, same question. I assume you seem to like it better with the amendment, even though it's still not good enough.
Madam Chair, I would probably say that there really hasn't been that much change because the reimbursement is the issue. And because it hasn't said that payers have the ability to pay less, reimburse less, then we really haven't changed much. Then I think we just need to talk a little bit more about this.
Okay, well, thank you for that. And I'm going to call on Representative Grinhagen, but I just want to say that there's still a little time until our omnibus bill gets marked up, I guess. So I hope that you will be talking with the proponents. Representative Grinhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, didn't we set up a mandate review process to see what the costs and ramifications were? I think somebody alluded that Has the bill gone through that process?
Representative Freiberg?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Representative Grunhagen. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the issue of which bills need to go through that process, I think, is not entirely clear from the way we set it up. I mean, in my mind, you know, that process was set up kind of under the assumption that we would, that it would apply when we are mandating new conditions to be covered by insurance. You know, we hear those bills from time to time. It's a little unclear to me whether this bill falls into that category. So whether or not we can include the bill in the omnibus. I mean, that's a little bit above my pay grade. I'm not chair of the Finance and Policy Committee.
And let me respond to that as well then, because I know that he's going to ask me next. So, Representative Grunhagen, I've read the language of that provision very, very carefully, and I don't believe I'm bound by it. And I don't think this bill needs to go through that provision. So that's my view on it. So I think it's available for us to put in the omnibus bill.
Okay. Just a follow-up question. It's just that some of the testimony with concerns or opposing the bill is that it's a complicated bill and it's got ramifications that are going to drive up the cost. Now, we may disagree with that. I'm not saying, you know, I understand that. But one of the things about going through the process that we set up is to see if to what degree that's a possibility, or if it will. That it's just my thought. And, you know, I'm not an expert in this area, but I just think that, you know, we set that up. And if it's going to drive, if you're getting testimony from industry people that it's going to have higher costs, it would pay to go through that just to satisfy those concerns. Anyway, I'm just giving you that food for thought, okay?
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And, you know, it's a judgment call, and I'm making the call this way. And, you know, yes, a lot of bills are complicated. We deal with a lot of complicated bills in the legislature, and especially in this committee, and especially around drug issues. It is very complicated, and it's very rare that we would have the PBMs saying, sure, this is a good idea. In fact, I've never heard them say that about any bill. And the answer is always it's going to raise prices. And mostly we hear a lot of that from the insurance, from the health insurers as well. So, you know, I just wonder, you know, I mean, these are complicated issues. There are really good, smart people working on this one. And I'm inviting the parties to continue working. I'm just letting them know that I think this is an issue that we should do something about, because in my mind, this is a patient safety issue. And, you know, that is a preeminent issue for me. So, and as we all, I think, agree, if patients get bad outcomes, that's a cost too.
Yep.
So thank you. And Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that explanation. And I know it's your judgment call. I would give you one more additional input. And that's, I have a real close friend who's been in the medical device industry for, 30, 40 years. He's a supervisor and he runs innovation projects. He's right in Eden Prairie there. But he just says that so many of the laws that are passed, sometimes state, mostly federal, they're just duplicative and they actually increase the cost rather than helping patients or verifying the information. So, you know, so I'm not an expert on it, and I think most of us on the committee aren't, and that's why I thought we set up that mandate review process. So I just ask you to think about it, okay? I'm not going to suggest what you do, but...
You know. I appreciate that, Representative Grunhagen. I hear you say that a lot. Think about it. That sort of implies that we do things without thinking about it. I think we think about stuff quite a bit around here. So appreciate your reminder to think, because but we do think.
So, thank you. Yeah, Madam Chair, sometimes we need additional information to think about.
Yes.
Okay.
That is true. That is true. All right. With that, then, members, we don't have the bill before us, so I can't lay it over, but just with great thanks to our testifiers. And Representative Freiberg, did you want to make a closing comment?
Sure. No, I appreciate your consideration of this. I think it addresses an important issue, a patient safety issue, as you described. I don't see it as duplicative. I think there's this, this white bagging process is occurring that's harming patients' choice and potentially their safety as well. So I appreciate the consideration of this bill, even on an informational basis.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Freiberg, and thanks again to all of the testifiers. So we will move on then to our final bill of the afternoon, House File 4161, Representative Richardson. And the chair will move that House File 4161 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. And I do want to just note for members that we have heard this in a very abbreviated form because we put it on the reinsurance bill as an amendment. But we still wanted to have Representative Richardson come and explain the bill and then lay it over for possible inclusion. So welcome back, Representative Richardson, and please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4161 requires private sector health plans and medical assistance plans to provide postnatal coverage, including a comprehensive postnatal visit within 3 weeks of the date of delivery, and also any postnatal visits recommended by the patient's healthcare provider between weeks 3 and 11 from the date of delivery, and a comprehensive postnatal visit 12 weeks from the date of delivery. The period after birth is often referred to as the fourth trimester. During this time, patients recovering from giving birth, they're adapting to hormones, caring for a little one, and there's lack of sleep, there's fatigue, pain, breastfeeding difficulties, stress, and then there's also concerns about onset or increased acuteness of mental health needs during that very vulnerable period as well. And right now, patients are not getting holistic care during that postpartum visit. What we tend to see is that the care is siloed, it's fragmented, and it's not taking a comprehensive approach that's talked about within the bill, like really being able to get to the full scope of not only the physical health needs, but also the mental health needs as well. We've talked in this committee a number of times about the significant maternal and infant health disparities that exist within the state, particularly related to Black and Indigenous mothers. And there's a movement nationally and locally to look at restructuring postpartum care as one of those important steps to reducing the unacceptable maternal mortality and morbidity disparities that we see. We know that newborns, typically they are seen within days of discharge from the hospital, because of the physiological changes that they're undergoing and that occur in those first few days and weeks of life. And it's no different for changes within the patients who are postpartum as well. And so the hope of this bill is to really be able to have care that is going to be individually tailored to the needs of the patient. And I would just also note for members as well that, this is a recommendation that comes not only from the American College of Obstetrician and Gynecologists, but also was a recommendation from the House Select Committee on Racial Justice as well. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will yield my time, and I do believe I have one testifier.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Richardson. So we have Dr. Elizabeth Bard-Hanke. Welcome to the committee. If you would please just go ahead and state your name again and your tell us who you represent, and please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Bard-Hanke, and I am a fellow of the Minnesota section of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, representing nearly 1,000 providers of women's health care in Minnesota. And we strongly support House File 4161. We were thrilled with the passage of the extension of medical assistance coverage for pregnant women to 12 months postpartum. This legislation is the logical and necessary next step to ensure that comprehensive postpartum care is covered by health insurers so that our patients receive the essential life-saving care they need to not only survive but thrive postpartum. In the United States, we face a rising maternal mortality rate, a staggering 24 per 100,000 births. In Minnesota, maternal mortality is lower, but it remains unacceptably high. At least half of the deaths occur after the birth of the infant. The mortality rate among women of color and indigenous women is three times that of white women, regardless of income or education. One facet to correct these trends is to provide ongoing, comprehensive, patient-centered postpartum care. The traditional model of a single postpartum visit at 4 to 6 weeks is insufficient, and it risks the life and health of our mothers. Earlier and ongoing care could have prevented a patient of mine who was diagnosed with gestational hypertension during her pregnancy and then returned 10 days postpartum with a catastrophic hemorrhagic stroke. The transition from pregnant to parent is sudden, and it's physically, emotionally, and socially intense, even when it's not complicated by pre-existing or pregnancy-induced conditions. Navigating these changes is further challenged by the need to care for and feed a newborn in the context of extraordinary sleep deprivation. Follow-up postpartum has been associated with decreased rates of postpartum mental health disorders, as well as improving coordination and transition to ongoing care for pregnancy-related and chronic medical conditions. By expanding our concept and insurance coverage for patient-centered, comprehensive postpartum care, we can better serve our mothers and families and therefore our communities at large. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for hearing HF 4161.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bard-Hanka. We really appreciate you being here this afternoon. Are there questions from members? Comments? Okay, well, I have three children, and I must say, even though it was a long time ago, your description really brings me right back to what that experience was like. And, anyone who's gone through that knows that even if you go in healthy, even if you have good circumstances, even if you have assistance, that the process and the experience of having a newborn and giving birth is one that is just can be overwhelming. And I'm sure that's true in the physical sense as well as the emotional sense. So thank you. Representative Richardson, did you want to have a final word on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will unmute. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill today, and also want to thank my testifier as well. And just to lift up that as we are looking to really address the unacceptable disparities that we are seeing within the state as it relates to Black women being, you know, 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth, that this is just one of the steps as we look for comprehensive community-based strategies to really address the disparities that we are seeing. So thank you very much for the opportunity, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Richardson. So with that, House File 4161 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. So members, we have reached the end of our agenda for this afternoon. Thank you all very much for your hard work this afternoon, and especially thanks to all the staff who put in all this extra time. And our next meeting is Monday, and we will hear about the budget bills, the agency budget bills, and have some more testimony and discussion on those. With that, I hope you all have a very happy and restful weekend, and we stand adjourned.